Okay, we're on page 126. In Pasuk Chaf Vav, the second line there, the end of the second line. We left off last week having Rivka's in the process of giving birth. She gave birth to Esav, and we discussed that, and now she's about to give birth to Yaakov, the twin brother. Just to introduce, the Gedolim in general, I mean, part of what makes them great is that they have a different perspective on how life unfolds. And most of us, even though we obviously value important things for the most part, but we don't work on ourselves in the sense that we use important things as a means to not advance ourselves, right? Because if I'm worrying about big things, I don't have to worry about me, which is a much harder spiritual struggle. And you find individuals like that, most people who are proactive in the community, they're not exceptional people. They have chosen jobs, which allow them theoretically to have a big impact, but they themselves are not more righteous because of it. And they feel they don't have to be because I'm doing good work. Like, why are you complaining about me? So that's true for all of us to a certain degree, no matter what position a person may be in. But the Gedolim were never like that. Rabbi Saul Salanter Zatzal, once he was traveling on a train, and the train had smoking cars, not smoking cars. He was in a smoking car because he smoked, and he was smoking. And there was a young man there, a young Jewish guy, who was complaining to him, like, the smoke is bothering me. So he said, fine. And Rabbi Saul Salanter opened the window so that the smoke would not stay in the car. And still, it didn't help. The man was a little bit nudgy. No, I'm still bothered by the smoke. And so Rizal Santos said, fine. And he extinguished the cigarette. And then as they pulled into the station, this young man sees there's throngs of people there. Now, Rizal Santos himself, you can't get away with this today just because we do it differently, but famous Gedolim of that time, Rizal Santos, the Chafetz Chaim, they used to dress simply. They didn't dress like rabbinically. In those days, what that meant was that you dress more like the average man, which was still okay, meaning it was respectful. It just wasn't like a dignitary or somebody who had honor. So you would wearing a button-down shirt, slacks, a cap, whatever it was. Today, obviously, if a rabbi wants to dress like the common man, it would be disgusting and disgraceful, right? That should not happen. But in those days, the common dress was okay, meaning it wasn't disrespectful. It just wasn't something elevated. So those who wanted to stay modest, the Chafetz Chaim, Rizal Salanter, others, used to dress in that fashion. So the young man had no idea who was staying in front of him. But then when they pull into the station, there's throngs of people there. And then he sees that as Rabbi Saul Salanter steps out, they all like throng together on him. And he realizes now he was nudging one of the Gedolei Hador, one of the great ones of the generation. So he ran up, he was very apologetic, and Rabbi Saul Salanter, of course, said, don't worry, obviously I forgive you, no harm done, and they went on. So the man had actually come to town to train in as a shochet, as the shochet for the town. And then while he was there, they said, okay, you have to be tested. We have Rabbi Saul Salanter here. That's who, you have to get his, Kabbalah from Rabbi Saul Salanter in order to be qualified as a shochet. So this guy was, a little bit embarrassed. Here he was the one who was just petering him, and now he has to go ask him to approve him to be the town shochet. So when you get approved to be a shochet, obviously you have to know the halachas. You have to know how to shacht, obviously. You have to know how to do the knife. And it's a process. But when you go for the bechina, let's say it like that, when you go to be tested, what the bochen, the tester, will test you on is first he'll test you on the knife. One of the differences, what makes a shechita knife a shechita knife, is that it has to be perfectly smooth. I should have brought one in. But it has to be perfectly smooth that it can't have any imperfections whatsoever. And the way you test it is, like, here's the blade. You hold the blade and you take your fingernail and you run it up and down, the tip and the side and the three sides. And then you can, because fingernails are very sensitive, you can feel if there's like even a minutest imperfection within the blade, and that's how you checked. And if there is, you're not allowed to use it. It would be a non-kosher shechita, and so you have to know how to sharpen on your stone and everything else. And then, of course, you have to know the halachos of shechita, which is their own, you know, quite a few chapters in Shulchan Aruch. So you saw Slaughter tested this young man, and the guy didn't know what he was doing. So you saw Slaughter said, "Don't worry, I'm going to stay here. We're going to learn together." And for a number of weeks, they learned together until Rabbi Saul Slaughter felt comfortable enough that the guy knew what he was doing, and he gave him the Kabbalah and Shechita. So Rabbi Saul Slaughter said afterwards, he remarked to one of his Talmidim that people, of course, you have to forgive people, but you don't really know if you've forgiven them for real, B'Lev Shalem, unless you're able to do something nice for them. So whenever, you know, somebody did something to me, I always try to make sure that I find myself in an opportunity where I could do something nice for them. If I'm able to do that, I know that I succeeded in actually forgiving them, like the Torah obligates us. Most of us, when we forgive somebody says, "I'm sorry," you're like, "Okay, don't worry about it." But you do worry about it. Like, you're never going to talk to that person the same way again. If somebody hurt you, there's like a... It's very rare that it shouldn't be a permanent break, that you'll ever come back together. But you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to forgive people for real. And you're supposed to repair the relationship for real. There should be no hakpadas. No, you shouldn't have any concerns with them whatsoever. And how do you know? Are you happy to do things for them at this point? So Rabbi Saul Slaughter, that's where his head was. Am I holding where I'm supposed to be holding, that I could be 100% nice to this person again? This is true not just on an individual level, but on a global level as well, to think about what does Hashem really want in this situation as opposed to, you know, the way the world normally works. So one of the great precedents for it is in this following pasuk. If we begin the second line there at the end, in pasuk chavav.
What page we are?
Oh, we're on page 126. V'achrei chen, and afterwards, Yasa Achiv, his brother came out, v'yado achazas ba'achiv, and his hand was holding on to his heel, meaning Ba'akev Esav, on the heel of Esav, Vayikra Shemo, and he called his name Yaakov, meaning Yaakov's name seems to be a play on the word of Akev, the heel of Esav that he was grabbing onto. Because he was grabbing onto the heel, the Akev, they called him Yaakov. V'Yitzchak ben Shishim Shana Baledos Osam. And Yitzchak was 60 years old when his wife gave birth to these children. If we look in Rashi, which one? We'll skip the first Rashi on this pasuk. We'll skip down to right in the middle of the first column. Be'ekav Esav. It's like just a little bit below the middle. So Rashi says, Be'ekav Esav, on the heel of Esav, Simon. This act of one baby holding on to the heel of the other one, it was a symbolic gesture. She'ein zem maspik ligmor machuso, that this one, meaning the first baby born, Esav, would not be able to complete his reign in its entirety, ad shezeh omei v'notel hemenu, until this one comes and takes it from him. Meaning, Esav would have dominion, he'd be able to rule over the world, basically, but he would never get to the final point where he achieved full world dominion, either with on a practical sense or with his ideologies, until Yaakov, at the very end, which here is symbolic of the end of days, at some point Yaakov is going to chop Esav at the heel. He's going to grab him at the very end, and things are going to flip around, and Yaakov's going to take charge at that point. So that's what we're always looking for. We're always looking in terms of history for the spiritual battles and what's going on. And a lot of the political battles, which we get so engrossed in, are really meaningless. Meaning that's the way Hashem's running the world, but they're very meaningless in terms of what we are looking to accomplish. So that's why you find that just like on a personal level, the Gedolim have, you know, a different outlook on life. On a global level, they also have a different outlook. When we talk about Israel, every so often, big people will say things that just like drive us crazy regarding Israel, because we're so invested in the war and our state, you know, the national state and our identity and this and that, and we're being persecuted, and all the political statements that we like to associate with ourselves with to put us on the right side of history. But that's not, that's a political perspective. It's not a Torah perspective. So you'll find often that, Avadia Yosef Zatzal, Rav Shach Zatzal, others, they were willing to give up a lot if it meant the safety of the Jewish people. So if the Arabs wanted this territory, that territory, they'd be, well, if it provides for increased safety, less Jews will die, then yes, that's what the Torah wants. And we recoil, what are they're giving away Israel, People get so angry, but they're not looking at it as, you know, in your plebeian political perspective, looking, what does Hashem want in this situation? Just recently, I'm not saying it's on the same level, but there came a letter signed by 80 rabbis, apparently, of, that accusing Israel of, or saying Israel has to be more careful, let's say, with how it treats civilians on the other side as well. And it caused a huge uproar in the news cycle. A lot of non-Jewish organizations quoted it. Look, even their own rabbis say so. And the religious Jewish world just went crazy. How, these are lunatics? How could they be saying these things? They're inciting anti-Semitism by agreeing with it. So Rabbi Blau, who was sort of the head signature on that letter, he used to be the mashgiach in YU. He got a bracha under my chuppah when I got married. He was one of the people there. I like him a lot. I don't agree with most of what he says, but I like him a lot. And he's a very intelligent person and a very sincere person as well. But he said, no, like, you can't be beholden to politics. You're right. People are going to jump on us politically. It doesn't mean Israel's necessarily doing the right thing. Whether or not it's politically, beneficial, you still have to do the right thing. You can't, if your policies are causing starvation to certain people, then you have to fix those policies. You can't, be blinded to the reality of what's happening. That's a more Torah true perspective. Whether or not the reality on the ground is as he says, okay, that could be argued. But if it is, then of course he's right. You can't fall into a political mindset at the expense of what Hashem wants you to do.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Regarding Esav, as we can see, like a homage, he already was born.
Yes.
Failing a test, right?
Failing
because it seems like he already doesn't. It seems like
from the birth, he was being. Yes, so that we spoke about last two times, he was being given a different role. He wasn't going to be the scholar sitting in the tent. He was going to be the man out in the street who was, so to speak, getting things done. But within that role, he could have excelled. He could have been a very righteous person within Olam Hazeh, meaning within his role in perfecting this world, of maintaining and sustaining the world we live in right now. He could have done a job very nicely without having to resort to evil.
So it wasn't destined to fail the test, right?
No, right. Every person has free will. that's what we say. Yeah. So here also, Yaakov is eventually, the Jews are going to the Jewish ideology, let's call it the Torah ideology, will eventually reign supreme. Obviously, as we say it every day in Aleinu, that Bayom Ahu, on that day, Yeshem Echad Shema Echad, there will come a day when obviously everybody will, the whole world, and it will be inescapable. We'll recognize the unity of Hashem and how the world displays Hashem's wisdom, etc., etc. And that's going to come at the end of, a whole historical record. Yaakov is going to have his hand on the heel and things are going to flip around. But until that point, we have to make do and with understanding Esav's going to be in charge, and we try our best within that framework. It rankles at a person, and this is not just true for today. It rankled at people 2,000 years ago when during the second Beis HaMikdash, when the Romans were laying their siege and everything else, attacking Yerushalayim, the rabbis wanted to create a peace with Rome. They wanted to let Rome rule because that would be better for the Jewish people. It would have preserved the Jewish state in Israel at the time. It would have preserved the Beis HaMikdash. It would have preserved tons of Jewish life. But the national character of the Jewish people, you know, the non-rabbis, let's say, couldn't deal with it. What? We're going to let Rome tell us what to do? We're not going to have independence. We're not going to da-da-da. And they refused to allow the rabbis. They created a war. They actually, as we know from Tisha B'Av, they burned down the supplies in order to force the Jews to fight. They couldn't rest on their supplies or their laurels or anything like that. And even Rabbi Yochanan, who was the great leader of the time, he tried to get out in order to talk to the Roman general to see if he could broker a peace. He had to go through a whole subterfuge just to get out of the gates where he pretended to be dead, and they let him out to be buried just so he could get out to try to broker a peace with the Roman general. It obviously didn't work in the end. The Romans attacked. Hundreds of thousands of Jews died. And it theoretically could have been avoided.
Was this also sort of in the same vein with the fast of Gedaliah, when the Jews killed Gedaliah and he was trying to work with the Romans?
Yeah. He was a Roman appointee, and he was considered righteous, meaning he wasn't a stooge.
So let me ask one more question then.
Yeah.
So then, as I was reading some stories, in the ghetto, or when the Nazis came in, you know, they would set up a Jew rep, you know, ahead of them. But they were working with the Germans to try to save. Is there any parallel between
the capos?
Well, and also the head of the communities that the Germans would set up. You know, they'd find somebody like a Geld or something in the love.
So, I mean, in terms of the
Jewish person in charge.
I mean, yeah, there is precedent for that, that it speaks about the Chumash. Obviously, we're not there yet in Sefer Shemos, that Paro was really the first person to do that. He set up Jewish taskmasters over the other Jews, meaning he put Jews in charge of Jews. And those were actually, in the Chumash, they were considered very righteous, that those people who were appointed those leadership positions, they actually suffered for their Jewish, rather than like when the government, the Egyptian government, requested, how many bricks you had to build, let's say, every day. And it wasn't really feasible to a large degree without the people killing themselves. The taskmaster said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And what taking care of it meant was that they got whipped instead for not delivering quota.
When does it cross the line of working with somebody to try to save people versus complicit with what's going on?
So, I mean, obviously case-by-case basis, but if you're not looking out for your own self-interest, you're trying to just save Jewish lives in general, then obviously you're on the right side. If you're utilizing your leadership position to save yourself at the expense of Jews, that's obviously crossing a line.
Well, it just seems like there's a point where are you really? Are you really helping, or are you really
assisting? So you're right. It's easy to fall on the wrong side. Yeah.
I have a question. Say we had given a small portion of Israel to the Arabs to keep peace and not have any wars.
We tried it.
How does the Torah feel about that? Are you not supposed to give away a piece of Israel?
You're not supposed to give away, and all things being equal, you're not even allowed to sell a piece of Israel to, like, if a non-Jew wants to buy a house in Israel. According to the halacha, you're not allowed to, but that's when the Jews are in charge, when there's a Beis HaMikdash and everything else. But when we're in a state of galus, then those rules don't apply in the same way. So in a state of galus, again, that's what we keep saying here, that the Torah wants us to acknowledge that we're not in charge at the moment, that it's Esav's turn, so to speak.
Oh, okay, so whatever happens.
So right now, the halacha says put the two things you have to worry about is promulgating Torah and saving Jewish lives. So if either one of those come under fire, go to war for it. Meaning if they want to close the yeshivas, go to war for it. If they want to kill Jews or do things that put Jewish lives in danger, go to war for it, which legitimizes a lot of what the Israeli army does. But things that the settlers are doing, that's not necessarily legitimate. Meaning living on land that incites anger, there's plenty of places where you can live without inciting anger in Israel. So I don't know if that's so simple. So then the next pasuk, in pasuk, Chav Zayin, Vayigdulu Hanarim, four lines down, the lads, the boys grew up, meaning they were born, and the boys started growing up. Vayhi Esav Ish Yodeh Sayid. And Esav turned out to be a person who knew, Sayid means like hunting or trapping. Ish Sadeh, he was a man of the field. Vayakov Ish Tam. And Yaakov, Tam is a little bit of a hard word to translate. We'll see how Rashi understands it, but just on a simple level, it means simple. He was a simple man without complication. Yoshev Olam, and he dwelt in the tents. So what does that mean? Was he a homebody? What exactly is the pasuk saying about him? So if we look in Rashi here, so Rashi says the three lines from the bottom. Vayigdalu hana'armim, vahi Esav, and the boys grew up, and behold Esav. Kozman shayu ketanim, all the time that they were small, meaning the boys were you know, like just kids, lo hayu nikar b'maaseihim. You couldn't really recognize who they were going to be via their actions. They did. They played games. They were friendly. They were pretty similar, Yaakov and Esav. Vein adam medaktik behem mativdom. And a person really couldn't discern what their nature was. But kevish and asa b'nei yud gimoshana, once they hit an age of maturity, they were bar mitzvah, which in those days was a real milestone. Meaning today, a kid gets bar mitzvah, he's still very much within the kid. Right, perspective, for another few years at least. He hasn't matured in any sense that we can discern. But in those days, it was a major demarcation. Once they hit that 13 years old, Zeb Pirish Abate Midrashos, Zeb Pirish Avodazara, then they started taking discernibly different paths. Yaakov went to the yeshivas, and Esav went in another direction. He started visiting the other houses of idol worship, of intellectual discussion, things that were not in line with Torah. That's what started drawing him, attracting him. This notion that it's hard to tell, and we spoke about before, it's hard to tell what a kid's going to be like. Obviously, some kids cause us a lot of frustration, but that's just the personality Hashem gave them. They're not intrinsically, obviously no kid's intrinsically a bad kid, but it's not even indicative of what their nature is. If a kid is a hashbokas and he's always jumping around and making you crazy, it doesn't reflect on who the kid is. It just means Hashem gave him, this excitable personality that makes it hard to concentrate. And everything like that. Even many of the Gedolim, they were not classic goody two-shoes when they were growing up. Reb Chaim Moser, who obviously was the great Eloi and the leader of the Jewish people prior to World War II, this is not in the biographies, but I heard from Rav Pesen Zatzal that there was a tradition in his family that they had sheiches with the Grzhenskis, that when Reb Chaim Ozer was little, on Yom Kippur, by Aleinu, when you're in the middle of davening, there's a part in Aleinu where everybody lays out their little mat on the ground or their paper towels, and they bow down all the way down in a way that we don't do, any other time of the year. So it was Yom Kippur, and a young Reb Chaim Ozer, 5 or 6 years old, he was waiting for that moment when they said Aleinu, and in the solemnity of the moment, the seriousness and the spirituality of bowing to Hashem in the midst of the Yom Kippur davening, and everybody bowed down, Reb Chaim Ozer pulled out, not Reb Chaim, Chaim, little Chaim, pulled out a paddle and went down the road, people smacking everybody on their behinds. So he turned out to be Reb Chaim Ozer. So when children are children, you never know. Don't give up on anybody. It's a lesson. Let's continue in Rashi. So the last word in the first column, Yodea Tzayed, Esav was well-versed in trapping. Lutzud, to trap, Ulramos, and to deceive as Aviv Bepiv. his father with his mouth, meaning the act of trapping was already core to the way Esav viewed the world, like how he dealt with people, and even his own father, he trapped him, meaning Esav presented himself in a way that made his father think he was somebody that he wasn't, and therefore caused his father to do certain things. How did he do that? How did Esav trap his father into a misperception? V'shalno, he would ask him, Abba, heich ma'asr nesamelach v'esatavon. How do we take ma'aser, meaning when in America we don't have it, but when you live in Eretz Yisrael, any food that you grow, you have to give ma'aser. You have to give a certain percentage of it to the Kohanim and to the Levim and give it away. And to poor people every few years. So that only applies, though, to produce that's grown. It's extended to vegetables as well, really anything grown, but not to things like salt or straw. So he would ask his father, how do we do that? How do we give ma'aser even from the salt or the straw? Meaning he made himself look so religious that he wanted to give ma'aser. He wanted to give Hashem his due for these things as well. Even though the halacha says you don't have to. So he was causing an erroneous perception of who he was. Kesavar Aviv and his father would think, Shehu medaktik b'mitzvos, that he was very careful in his mitzvah observance. Another Rashi, Ish Sadeh kemashmo adam batal. When it says he was a man of the field, the implication is he was a man who was batal. Meaning he wasn't doing standard work. Vitsuda bakashaso chayes ba'ofos, bakashto chayes ba'ofos. And he would trap or hunt with his arrow. His weapon of choice was bows and arrows, wild animals and birds. So here the Mefarshim point out that he was, that it wasn't he was lazy. He was very much not lazy. But we know that when people have, let's say, by wealthy families, oftentimes their children who don't really have financial concerns, they don't always follow the same, you know, get educated, get a job route that children from lesser wealth or families might pursue just as a natural matter of course. Rather, they get into something and they'll dedicate a lot of effort to it. And in the old days, amongst the noble families in Europe, hunting was one of those things. The people were very into hunting, their fox hunting and their falconry and things like that. But it was very much a rich person's hobby. It was not something for the, you know, the common man. And they weren't lazy. It could have been they were very into it and perfecting their skills and everything. But it reflected that they weren't going to work. And that's certainly what reflected. Okay. So
it's not forbidden. I know the Torah wasn't given, but it's confusing because some mitzvahs are already performed at the time, right? So, like you said, that he mentioned that, can we give the I forgot the
Meiser, yeah.
Yes. So hunting was forbidden according to the Torah, right? You cannot kill
no.
an animal.
So there is a tshuva from the Noda Bihud in the 1700s. So in Europe, one of the things that, like until relatively recently, actually, there was a position, I don't know what the name of it is, but somebody who would lead you on a safari, right? So people used to pay, you know, some local African expert to take them into the jungle so that they could hunt successfully because they didn't know what they were doing. And who would lead them around, make sure they didn't get killed and show them where the lions or elephants were that they could shoot and come back with a trophy and things like that. Obviously, it's fallen out of favor the past few years, but that's always been a big thing. So in the 1700s, it was also a thing, not to go to Africa per se, but even in the forest in Europe. So there was a Jewish person who was very adept woodsman, let's say, hunter. And he asked the Noda Bihuda, who was the chief rabbi of Prague at the time, what does the Torah say about it? Am I allowed to do this? What's the question? The question is, the non-Jews who are hunting, if you're hiring a guide, you're doing it for sport. You're not doing it because you need a deer to eat or something like that. Today in America, there are a lot of people who hunt for food, and that's 100% permissible. But let's say you're doing it for sport. So that was this Jewish person's question. He might not be the one killing the animals, but can he lead groups of the non-Jews to go hunting? Or is there a problem since it's considered for sport and not per se for, you know, because I need food to eat, maybe we should invoke the prohibition of Tsar Balei Chaim, causing unnecessary pain to animals. Would that apply in such a case? And therefore, he wouldn't be allowed to do it. So Noda Bihuda has two parts in that tshuva, and he writes that, first of all, it's not forbidden. Anything that's for human benefit is permissible, meaning you can't cause wanton violence or just hurt an animal for the sake of hurting it. But if it's as part of leisure and it's considered a sport and things like that, it might not be savory, but it is for human benefit. And if you can make parnasa off of it and you're not going to be the one involved per se, it's definitely mutter, meaning you're permitted to do it. It's not considered, you know, violence for the sake of violence. However, he says, if you look in the Torah, aside from the halacha, the only two people who are mentioned as hunters in the Torah are Nimrod and Esav, and those were not good people. So obviously the profession of hunting is one that's identified with people who are not righteous. So he said, in general, it's not forbidden, but you should stay away from it. The poskim today do discuss, let's say, going fishing. Is there any reason a Jew shouldn't be able to go fishing? So this is, again, it would just be simply, certainly catch and release, I think without a question, you shouldn't do that, because that's causing pain to animals for no reason. But what about going fishing for a leisure activity, but you're going to eat the fish you catch? It's not going to be just a wasteful pain. So then it would hinge on the question of, is there a way to catch fish without causing the pain? Or do fish even feel pain when they get caught? So this is actually surprisingly a big controversy among scientists. To what degree do fish feel pain? And they've done lots of experiments where, how do you know if a fish feels pain or not? The fact that it fights against you, you just put your hand on it, it'll fight against you. It doesn't mean it's in pain. So they've done, in 2002, they identified nociceptors, which are the kinds of nerves which in humans feel pain. But in humans, those nerve bundles which feel pain, those nociceptors, they're connected to a part of the brain, which is where the pain registers. Fish don't have that part of the brain. So there's this back and forth. We have no way to know whether or not the fish is feeling pain. And there's contradictory studies which they seem to release chemicals which humans release when they feel pain. But on the other hand, there's other biological factors which speak in the other direction, saying, no, look at this and this and this. And there's no learned response, meaning if a fish feels pain, animals have a very good ability to adapt when a situation is painful, not to repeat the situation. Like Pavlovian dog, right? Would they get acclimated to this is good and this is bad, they stay away from bad. And yet they, even though hooks and other things are, an animal could be trained to see what they are, but they find a lot of fish could be, they eat the hook again and again and again, the same fish. So apparently it's not the negative experience for them that, we would think it would be. I think just on fishing, if you're going to catch and release, not. But if you want to do it for fun, and you're willing to eat the fish, then there's enough to say it should be permitted. So here Esav was involved in hunting. Now we said it was a rich person's thing. The Torah's not telling us that. He was involved in hunting. That's a rich person thing. But Rabbi Yochum says what it is telling us is that what he wanted to do was not be involved in Torah. Meaning, for Yaakov and Esav, their father was wealthy, first of all. Yitzchak was very wealthy. Avram gave him a tremendous fortune. He himself, increased the fortune. Money wasn't really an issue. But that's not why Esav was hunting, because that was not, they were bigger than that. Esav was hunting because he didn't want to do what Yaakov was doing, which was subjugating himself to learning Torah, which, as we know in ourselves, it's very hard to do. That to sit down, to have a Seder, meaning we come once a week, which is Gevaldik, and that's amazing. But for a man who has a real chiyuv, a real responsibility to learn Torah you know, stark and every day and depth. A lot of times when I speak to different crowds, I tell them, you know, there are 24 hours in a day. One of those hours every day you could dedicate to Hashem and learning Torah. You know, and we'll set you up a night seder at night, 1 hour a night. A person comes home, let's say around 6 o'clock, goes to bed 10 or 6:30, 10:30. There's 4 hours every night. You need to eat dinner, fine. But one of those 4 hours, let it be in the base medrash. The other 3 hours, you know, watch TV, play with your kids, whatever you feel is important. There's such pushback about agreeing to spend one out of every 24 hours learning Torah, you wouldn't believe. And it's from very rational, very righteous people, meaning that they're leading good, very good lives. They're very sincere in everything they do. It's just there's a tremendous Yetzirah to subjugate yourself to learn Torah, to find out what Hashem wants from you. And it's understandable. And Esav is the poster boy for forsaking. There was the opportunity. The money was there. The yeshiva was there. Esav said, no, I'm going a different direction. I refuse to allow myself to be beholden to that. And Yaakov, on the other hand, if we continue in Rashi, Tam, the third line, Tam, eino bakib kol ela. Yaakov, when he's described as simple, Rashi's saying, it doesn't mean he was stupid. It means he wasn't expert in deception. Esav had such a good grasp on, you know, the workings of the physical world and people's psychology and what it took to be respected and what it took to portray yourself in certain ways, that he knew what he wanted and he knew how to accomplish it. And to borrow a biological term, his phenotype, the way he presented, was very different than his genotype, than who he actually was. Yaakov didn't have that expertise. Yaakov did not have, you know, his heart telling him one thing, but his presentation saying another. Eino baki b'kol ela, he was not expert in all these. Elo kalibo kein piv, whatever was in his heart, that's what was in his mouth. He was a very sincere, honest, in Yiddish we'd say erlich, meaning there was no deception there, there was no discrepancy between who he was and how he behaved. Misha eino charif l'ramos, somebody who's not sharp to deceive people, Kari Tam. We call him a Tam. So even though we, who feel like we like to think of ourselves as capable people, and capable means being able to interact with people and getting what you want, people who don't do that, who just say what they think, we call them naive, right? Oh, he's very innocent, right? And when we say innocent, we mean that it's nice, but derogatory. Like, he's innocent. He's going to get swindled. He's not somebody who interacts properly with the world. Yaakov was that person, super intelligent, as we're going to see, but not one who felt that he had to portray himself or accomplish things with any note of deception. If he felt it, he said it. If he said it, you know that was the emes of who he was. And then Rashi continues, Yoshev Olam, he sat in the tents, Olo Shashem, Olo Shaever. Those were the yeshivas of the day, the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever. Rav Moshe points out here that Yaakov, unlike the other Avos, and we're about to see what happens with Yitzchak, but we already saw what happened with Avram. Of the three Avos, Avram and Yitzchak faced tremendous personal challenge and trying situations during their lives. Obviously, Avram was thrown into the fiery furnace. His wife was kidnapped twice. He was told he had to offer up his son. Yitzchak, we're about to find out, you know, what trials and tribulations he had to go through. Yaakov wasn't quite the same. For much of his life, it was a relatively peaceful existence. And it didn't have, you know, that intense, you know, binding of Isaac trial kind of test that the other Avos had. So Rabbi Yaakov said that wasn't Yaakov's test. His test was consistency. Hasmada, it's very hard to, like we just said, to come to the base medrash every night, to sit there, to concentrate, to grow within your learning. That consistency, it was Yaakov's nisayon. And it was as much of a nisayon, as much of a test, it was as trying on Yaakov's personality as Avram having to offer up his son. Obviously, we're dismissive of that notion. How could that be? One's your son, and one is just coming to the base medrash every night. But because of its simplicity, we tend to be dismissive of it, and yet, when push comes to shove, we don't do it, right? I could do that also. It's not a big deal. And yet you don't. Why not? Because it's really hard. It's really hard to be, to have that level of dedication that you just come every night, no matter what. If we continue in the next pasuk, Chaf Ches, Vayev Yitzchak es Esav, Yitzchak loved Esav, ki tzayd bepiv, because there was a tzayd here means the food that he was hunting, or it could mean the act of hunting. We'll have to see how Rashi understands it, was in Yitzchak's mouth, meaning on a simple level, the animals that Esav hunted, he would then barbecue however he made it, and he would give it to Yitzchak. And so Esav was the source of his dinner, so to speak, for Rivka. But Rivka, on the other hand, Ohevah says Yaakov, she loved Yaakov. Let's see Rashi here. Chaf Ches, four lines down the second column at the very end. Kitzayit bepiv, for his hunted food was in his mouth. Ketargimo, as the Targum explains, who's bepiv here? Whose mouth? It doesn't identify. Bepiv shel Yitzchak. It means in the mouth of Yitzchak. Medrash, however, the Medrash understands this pasuk, bepiv shel Esav, that Esav's trapping was in his own mouth. He was shahayit sad also, because he was deceitful to his father, Marmehu b'dvarav, and lied to him with his words, as Rashi mentioned before. He made himself appear to be somebody who he wasn't. So here, the Or HaChaim points out that Esav didn't do this for Rivka. It says he was only deceitful towards his father, but not towards his mother. So the Or HaChaim says, due to who Esav was, which was, this was Esav's world, and he wanted to maximize, accomplish what he wanted to accomplish in this world, get what he could from this world, the vehicle to getting that was not via his mother, it was via his father. His father was the one who, in the end, would both give him the monetary wealth, but more importantly, the bracha of success in this world. So everything he did, whether consciously or subconsciously, was aimed at his father, because he allowed himself to adapt to be a manipulative personality. That manipulation did not show itself to his mother, because his mother, in terms of what he wanted to accomplish, was inconsequential. His mother couldn't deliver him anything he wanted. So for his mother, he could be honest, so to speak. Not that he was consciously doing so, but there was no need for a proactive act of manipulation with his mother. He could just be who he was, because he didn't want anything from her. So she could see him clearly for who he was, which was not the case for his father. His father, he wanted everything from his father, so he had this proactive act of manipulation in order to present himself as the perfect son, and that his father should love him for it. And the pasuk says, to a degree it worked, that Yitzchak did love Esau, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Yeah.
Don't you think Yitzchak was also complicit in the way he dealt with Esau? I mean, he could have checked it. He didn't. I mean, he was part of Esau. I mean, he probably was okay with some of the things he was doing. I mean, it sounds like Esau was the only one tricking somebody, but in reality, maybe Isaac went along with it because he, for some reason, was okay with some of the things that were being done. I mean, is it all one way? Or could it be that, your kid's good at sports. So, he could be in cheder or study, but he's a good football player.
Yeah.
So the father says, I got two sons. One's good in sports and one isn't so good in sports. Maybe I like the one that's good in sports, so I'm going to go to all the games and I'm going to encourage him. For the other one, maybe not so much, and maybe goes on. So I don't know if it's just a one-way street, is what I was thinking.
You're asking, did Yitzchak enable Esau's behavior?
I mean, when he was going to school and not going to yeshiva, did he not know? Did he not check on him? Say, where was my kid here?
Right.
No, he was in the field.
No, he knew he was in the field. So this gets... We're out of time. Okay, let's just answer this question. We'll pick up from here next week. But and this is a good place to stop as well. The Mefarshim do deal extensively. The commentators deal extensively with that question, but they phrase it in the way that Yitzhak was the great spiritual leader of the generation. How could he not recognize who Esav was? Meaning, was he really Yitzhak himself so naive as to be taken in by a manipulator, even if it is his own son? No, clearly not. Yitzhak was able to recognize who Esav was. He understood that Esav's role was not Yaakov, that they were two totally different people, and that Esav was meant to be this world, the Olam Hazeh, right? The one who did everything. This was his life, so to speak, was everything that took place in the here and now. And Yaakov was the spiritually transcendent one. That being the case, Yitzchak represent the Midah of Din. The Midah of Din, of justice, is one where there's no chesed, there's no forbearance, there's no kindness, where a person's able to live on a very absolute one-to-one judgment pattern with God, where if I do something right, I get rewarded. If I do something wrong, I get punished. And for most of us, that's very hard because we do things wrong consistently, unfortunately. So we ask Hashem to have mercy and to give us time and we'll do better. And as we're going to say in our prayers. But for Yitzchak, who he didn't have that. He represented the Midah of Din, of Gevur, strength and justice. And he lived a lifestyle where there was no weakness in his personality, meaning he lived, a perfect life, where he didn't need to ask God for mercy because he himself was strong enough to do what he needed to do. That whole concept of being a perfect servant, of serving God perfectly within the confines of our world, the Olam Hazeh, this world, is there to give us room to do avoda. So Yitzchak very much saw our world as a place which we're supposed to be there to do the avoda, and you could live perfectly within that world. And that's what he thought Esav was going to be. He didn't expect him to send the Beis Medrash. He wanted him to be righteous in the field. He wanted him to have those blood-soaked hands, not in a negative way, but in a positive way of utilizing this world and creating the substrate via which, let's say, his brother Yaakov could then transcend into a more spiritual existence. So because Yitzchak's appreciation for this world was unbelievably positive. What do you mean? Because we live in this world, this world has all the potential for us to serve God in it. If we were just angels, we couldn't serve God. He loved this world. It allowed him to be who he was. And he saw Esav as an essential part of that. Rivka, on the other hand, grew up understanding that most people are not like that. She grew up with people, her family were evil to a large degree, and she understood that if you live in this world, ideally you should be like Yitzchak, but that's not the reality. The reality is once you make that turn to go to this world instead of the world to come, it schleps you down and it changes your perspective. And you become a this world kind of person as opposed to a Yitzchak who was a heavenly person living in this world. You become a this kind of world person living in this world. So that was the discrepancy in the philosophy between Yitzchak and Rivka, their parents. Yitzchak saw unbelievable potential in Esav, and Rivka recognized the reality of his situation and what he likely was going to turn out to be. Okay, let's see next.
That's deep. Because I also found the